When Utah lawmakers passed a law last month to ban fluoride from public drinking water, they say they had the reasons for doing it, but not one of those reasons was that fluoride in the water is bad for you. I mean, it might be, and some people did tell them it is, but that's not why they banned it. Lawmakers and the governor said it was about personal choice. They didn't believe citizens should be forced to be medicated by the government. So outside of the question of whether it's a dangerous industrial waste, as Robert F. Kennedy Jr. says it is, fluoride has also been something of a cultural proxy for these deep anxieties about government overreach and public health mandates. The historian Robert Dalek recently told us how this all began. He said it was the far-right organization, the John Birch Society, that first made fluoride a political flashpoint.
So the John Birch Society was a group of about 60 to 100,000 Americans, and they styled themselves as this anti-communist shock force. The animating idea behind the movement was that the United States was losing the Cold War. The communists were making inroads not only overseas, but also domestically. And so this kind of grassroots movement was formed in late 1958 in order ostensibly to kind of educate, to tutor the country in what was happening under their noses, and yet they hadn't quite realized it.
The Birchers believed the civil rights movement was a commie plot, just like the environmental movement and the UN and the Federal Reserve. And one of the things they thought was happening right under Americans' noses, the communists were poisoning our water. Dalek says there's a perfect illustration of this in the classic black comedy Dr. Strangelove from 1964.
It really is an iconic scene. Primarily, or at least in part, because it was such an incredible send-up of this allegedly crazed conspiracy theory that the communists had put poison in the form of fluoride in the drinking water.
Mandrake.
Yes, Dad?
Have you ever seen a commie drink a glass of water?
The general, Jack Ripper, is going on a rant as he's about to launch basically World War III and explaining that, you know, the communists have committed this diabolical act of forcing all Americans to ingest this poison.
70% of you is water. And as human beings, you and I need fresh, pure water to replenish our precious bodily fluids. Are you beginning to understand?
You know, he's kind of frothing at the mouth as he's saying this. And yet he clearly totally believes in what he's saying.
Mandrake, have you never wondered why I drink only distilled water or rainwater and only pure grain alcohol?
And he's got a position of power, and he's spouting this conspiracy theory.
Do you realize that fluoridation is the most monstrously conceived and dangerous communist plot we have ever had to face?
And, you know, it resonated then, and I think it resonates today because there was something really zany about this general talking about this conspiracy theory. But also because by the time Dr. Strangelove came out, the John Birch Society had become a household name. Most Americans knew what it was. They knew it was associated with conspiracy theories, like the baseless charge that Dwight Eisenhower was a dedicated agent of the communist conspiracy. Bob Dylan had done a spoof about the Birch Society called Talking John Birch Paranoid Blues. And the Birchers had also helped popularize the fluoride conspiracy theory. And so the scene in Dr. Strangelove kind of epitomizes a paranoia, mostly on the far right, that, you know, have really lost their minds because they are so obsessed with seeing communists, finding them under every rock.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. So today in the program, we're talking about fluoride. Utah, of course, is the first state to ban it from public water systems. But the debate isn't just about the science, though we will get to that a little bit later. Matthew Dalek said the John Birchers and others thought fluoride was a communist plot because it meant the government would start controlling people's lives and stripping away their individual identity.
I think the theory took much of its force from not just the fact that, you know, the country was in the middle of the Cold War, this existential struggle against communism and this totalitarian threat, but this idea over many decades that the American government itself had expanded by leaps and bounds and had started to trample on people's individual freedoms. And one of the ways it had trampled on their freedoms was by forcing these public health experts, federal scientists, forcing all Americans to ingest this chemical in something that everybody needed to survive on, which is the drinking water. And so, you know, as the Birch Society called fluoride, it was a massive wedge for socialized medicine. And so that there was something that the government was turning individual red-blooded Americans into robots, right? And that they had no free will over whether to put this in their water, take it into their bodies or not.
So, okay, so there are two parts here that are really interesting. The first is that I guess that they basically believed that these apparatchiks would leave very little for people to choose for themselves, that the government was going to rule over their lives, that this was going to be a wedge into socialized medicine. So there's that part. But then the other part was more direct. The other argument, as you say, is that putting fluoride in the water was an actual strategy about an actual chemical that was designed to alter Americans' minds, right?
Yeah, that's the gist of the theory. And we got to remember, too, that, you know, conspiracy theories are not necessarily consistent.
Yeah.
They evolve over time. Right. They're sometimes pretty vague. But the gist of this, I think, second argument from the John Birch Society, from other opponents of fluoride, is that this was a communist poison. And there were a lot of fears in the United States in the 1950s and 60s that Americans were going to be brainwashed, kind of convert people without them knowing it to the communist mindset. And so fluoride was seen as part of this, you know, one prong in this broader effort to, again, to somehow twist people's minds, to poison their brains somehow, and that it was a form of communist poison that, again, was really a perfect communist conspiracy because fluoride is unseen. It's in the drinking water. You need to drink it in order to live. You can't taste it. In a way, it was sort of the perfect conspiracy theory.
So how does the theory go over in mainstream America? I get that it's probably appealing, of course, to John Birchers or even to extreme conservatives. But what about the rest of the country? What did they make of the idea?
So I think in the 1950s and 60s, majority of Americans accept fluoride in the drinking water. They view it as a safe and reasonable public health intervention. And I think by, I don't know, the 1970s, 1980s, roughly around three quarters of the United States has fluoride in the public drinking water. Now, there are some efforts in the 1960s led by the John Birchers and their allies to put fluoride to a vote in local communities, basically referendum campaigns. So, apparently in 1968 in Omaha, Nebraska, for example, Ginny Thomas, the spouse of Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas, her parents were, according to a neighbor, leaders of the anti-fluoride campaign in Omaha. And these campaigns, you know, popped up. Again, they were locally oriented. They received some support, but they did not gain the kind of widespread popular traction that we might see anti-fluoride movements or anti-vaccine movements gaining today. It was seen as a fringe theory. Scientists were, for the most part, trusted. And many of the sources of American progress, scientific, technological, military progress, the victory in World War II, for example, you know, a lot of this was attributed to the United States, its scientific and technological prowess. And so things like fluoride were of a piece with that.
So what do you see in this current conversation and debate about fluoride in the water that might be a remnant from the fluoride controversy, you know, that the John Birchers were talking about in the 50s and 60s? Compare and contrast now to then.
Well, you know, it's interesting, these ideas which in the 1960s were widely dismissed as part of a so-called paranoid fringe.
Yeah.
Those ideas don't necessarily die. I mean, the John Birch Society as an organization and as a movement faded. And by the mid-1970s, it was really a shadow of its old self. But the idea that fluoride was suspect lived on. And in fact, even in throughout the late 20th century, during the Tea Party wave in the 2010s, there are movements in various parts of the country to stop fluoride from being put into the drinking water. So you see, you know, a kind of ideological lineage for the anti-fluoride forces. And then it's still an idea today that government is forcing you to put something in your body that could be poisonous or ruinous to you. I think that resonates with people. But the biggest difference between then and now is that it's become more mainstream, much more accepted. And there are a lot of reasons for that. One, I think, is a reaction to the pandemic, the anger, the public anger toward public health officials, the suspicion toward vaccines. I think that unlike in the 1960s, all of us living in 2025 are far removed from a time when, you know, dental decay or things like measles and mumps and polio were major threats to people's lives, right? Because, you know, people in the 60s had that memory. We sort of have lost that fear in a sense, which I think has lowered the threshold that people have and made in some ways people a little more complacent about some of these threats. But look, I think that suspicion of elites, suspicion of scientists, a roiling anger toward government, which again did not exist in the same way in the 1960s, but that has really come to define American politics, American life in much of this century. I think these are all shifts, and the anti-fluoride, anti-vaccine movements of today, and that we see with RFK Jr., Secretary of Health and Human Services, I think are all reflections of just how much momentum and power these movements have gained.
Can you look and see what happened to the, you know, the OG fluoride conspiracy theory from the 50s and 60s? Can you look and see what happened to it and get any sense of what might happen to not just the fluoride, but as you said, the conversation and debate going on now about vaccines and these questions, these larger questions about science? Do you get any indication of how these things play out from the past?
Well, it's a really interesting question. And I think the answer is, even though I'm a historian, not that much. And the reason I say that is because, you know, we live in a very different country now with very different attitudes about science and government. We have a very different media ecosystem. And the trust, I think, that most Americans had in institutions, in government, which they saw really as responsible, many Americans saw as responsible for helping the United States save capitalism during the Great Depression and then save democracy from the fascist threat in World War II and then help fight and win ultimately the Cold War. I think that those assumptions are no longer really operational. So the kind of pushback that we saw toward the fluoride conspiracy theories in the 1960s, I don't think that society has found ways to sort of relegate it to the margins once again. Having said that, though, it is possible that if, let's say, states or localities or the country as a whole starts to remove fluoride from the drinking water, or let's say says to schools that you don't have to require kids to be vaccinated. Yeah. And we see all kinds of harms result from that. We see outbreaks of disease. We see kids getting polio again. You know, that could then cause a rethinking, right? A sort of backlash to this much more anti-science, anti-public health movement that's currently ascendant. So I think we're in a particular moment now, but that could well change depending on, you know, what this anti-public health moment yields in terms of disease and dental health for the American people.
Mm. Well, Matthew Dalek, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Matthew Dalek, he's a professor of political management at George Washington University. He has a book called Birchers, How the John Birch Society Radicalized the American Right. We'll take a break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about fluoride in public drinking water, which, as you know, has been banned in Utah starting next month. Now, we'll explain what the science tells us about fluoride here in a minute, but we're also looking at how fluoride has become a kind of stand-in for these political tensions in the country. And then there's the question of whether Utah is leading the way to make America healthy again, which is what Robert F. Kennedy Jr. said in remarks at the University of Utah last week. Kennedy has directed the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention to stop recommending community water fluoridation around the country. He said he was very proud of Utah for the fluoride ban and for a few other bills they had passed. We asked KUER Sage Miller to help us understand the political dimensions to the story here in Utah. She says there have been a few efforts to get fluoride into the state's public water systems in the past, but nothing really caught on until the year 2000.
What happens in 2000 is cities essentially were given the choice on whether they wanted to put the issue of fluoridating the water on the ballot, making it essentially a voter's decision in local municipalities. The state didn't want to say, didn't want to mandate that we fluoridate or didn't want to fluoridate. They just said, hey, this is maybe a local control issue. We're going to let the voters decide. And that's where we saw Davis County and we saw Salt Lake County voters approved that measure that they wanted to fluoridate the water. And that's when they began doing so. But the state had really kind of left their hand out of it. I know that there was a national movement to begin doing it because it was considered a very big, one of the largest public health advances in the nation, specifically when it came to oral health. And those who most likely can't afford to go to the dentist pretty regularly. So this was seen as essentially a preventative care issue.
Yeah.
But yeah, the state didn't necessarily really want to touch it. And so they said, you know, if municipalities, if you want to take up this issue and you want to hand it to voters, we're going to let you.
Okay, so fast forward, we get to the 2025 legislative session. Where does this proposal to ban fluoride from the drinking water, where does it come from? And I guess the obvious question is, was this bill that was run and then passed a response to the MAHA moment and in specific the ideas of Robert F. Kennedy Jr. and others who were suspicious of, described fluoride as toxic?
I think that on the surface, or maybe from an outside view, it looks like, yeah, there's a pretty strong correlation there between when the conversation around fluoride and it being actually a negative benefit to health rather than a positive benefit, and then the Utah legislature running this piece of legislation. However, the Republican representative, Stephanie Grecius, I think would argue, no, that RFK and his position on fluoride and it being on the national stage was not the sole reason or the main reason why she decided to run this bill. And one of the strongest arguments that I heard listening back to the committee hearings was actually from employees at water districts or who have worked with fluoridated water in the past. They actually encouraged Stephanie Grecius to run this bill as well, mostly
Why?
Because it was really dangerous to work with in high concentration, in high concentrations. And they are working with like pounds and pounds and pounds of it, depending on where you are in the county. And so that was a big argument you heard from people who were public utility workers, that they have constant headaches or they've been told not to close their workers' comp claim because this isn't the effects of high exposure to the concentrations of fluoride. It's not going to go away. It may be like a lifelong problem. And so she made the argument during a committee hearing when she was presenting the bill in front of her colleagues that this really came down to a few issues, but number one being a lawsuit that the EPA lost to some plaintiffs in California, which essentially just said, hey, the argument was, we have some concerns about fluoride. There's been more medical advancements about large quantities of fluoride entering the water system and what that actually means for people's health and who can be impacted by large levels of fluoride. The judge ruled, while there seems to be some evidence to show that there are perhaps consequences to elevated levels of fluoride in the water, and we should take a pause and we should look at those. The judge in California did not say that it does cause negative health consequences. It just said
it's worth a look.
It's worth a look.
Yeah.
And so she made the argument, Stephanie Grecius made the argument, that Utah doesn't want to be involved in a lawsuit, and this could be a potential legal consequence if we continue to fluoridate the water when there is a federal judge that says, hey, maybe we should pause and take a look. So she said, let's just get rid of it. That's how she started off her argument.
Well, that's what she said, and I won't question her motives, but it does also seem – I think people hearing that are going to be a little
– skeptical.
Skeptical, because it also so happens that around the time she's suggesting there's a lawsuit that should make the state ban fluoride from drinking water, a big Donald Trump supporter – Robert F. Kennedy Jr. And the whole MAHA moment is also raising questions about fluoride. But she says it's not connected, not necessarily.
Not necessarily connected. But I do think that there is this argument that we've heard very much so, especially since the 2016 election, that now all politics are national rather than local. And this has been in the national spotlight. Mm-hmm. So I do see, like personally, I do see that how there is a correlation between those two things, even if the argument Grecius is making on the front is that this is mostly just to save Utah from a lawsuit, a potential lawsuit down the pipeline. But I also think that Utah aligns a lot with the Trump administration. We're a very deeply red state. The governmental control does support the Trump administration, and we saw that when nearly 60% of Utahns voted for President Donald Trump. So it makes sense that they would kind of follow the line. And when you have the Secretary of Health and Human Services saying, we should take a look at fluoride, maybe this is causing negative consequences, and then throwing out a bunch of claims about it, I'm not surprised that Utah would fall in lockstep.
I guess I'm confused why she wouldn't just say that. Why she wouldn't just say, yeah, we are a Republican state. We support Donald Trump. His Secretary of Health and Human Services has suggested there are some problems with fluoride.
Yeah, she said this was an issue that she'd been looking at for a long while.
That predated MAHA.
Yeah. That maybe just gained momentum now.
Yeah.
And she did stand next to RFK when he visited Utah to applaud lawmakers for championing some MAHA legislation, one of those pieces of legislation being removing fluoride from public water systems.
Tell us a little bit about this Representative Grecius. What's she like? Are our inclinations like really conservative? Does she tell us a little bit about her?
Yeah, she's fairly new to the legislature. She began her service in 2023. She represents Utah County. Yeah. And I think in those 2 years prior to her third session, which was in 2025, she kind of was pretty quiet. And it seems in this year, she has really kind of been in the spotlight of doing these more controversial issues. For example, there was a fluoride bill that she sponsored. And then she also was the sponsor of the piece of legislation that bans transgender students from living in specific dorms on college campuses. Mm. So she really has been, I think, maybe more titled the firebrand this year.
So in signing the bill, Governor Cox said that, as he put it, there wasn't sufficient evidence to require people to be medicated by their government. So mm-hmm. he signs this bill. And the idea of it being a medication – so lawmakers are thinking about this as a medication. Grecius described it as a medical freedom issue. Say a little bit more about that.
This argument I actually found very, very interesting because it's one that I hadn't heard before when it came to the conversation. And what they're saying is that, again, part of the reason why there was this push to even fluoridate the water was as a preventative care method. And the argument, the larger argument that she was making was it is not the duty of a government to mass medicate a population without their consent. And even though people voted for it, it wasn't all people that voted for it. It didn't get 100% approval. And therefore, it is not the proper role of government to make these medical decisions for their constituents, for their citizens, for their residents.
Same thing the governor said.
Yeah.
The other argument I think is interesting is that she seemed to be making, and maybe even some of the other lawmakers, that this was a bodily autonomy issue.
Mm-hmm. That parents should be able to choose what their kids ingest and what kind of care their kids receive. And again, it is not the proper role of the government in order to do that. And additionally, let's say somebody doesn't want any fluoride in their body. They are allergic or have negative health consequences, whatever it may be. They can't escape it because it's there when you shower. It's there when you boil pasta. It's there when you like fill up your water bottle from the tap. Like it's inescapable.
Yeah.
And so therefore, people essentially don't have the agency. They don't have the choice to remove themselves from consuming fluoride because it's everywhere in your public water system.
Okay. So along with Representative Grecius, there were other lawmakers standing next to Robert F. Kennedy Jr. when he came recently. Mention some of the other laws that were in that sort of MAHA vein that Utahns have now signed on to.
Yeah. So there was a fluoride bill that was championed by RFK. He was really happy about it. And then there was two other pieces of legislation, both sponsored by Republican Representative Christine Chevrier.
Also of Utah County.
And one of them dealt with removing or no longer being able to add artificial dyes and preservatives into school lunches.
Yeah.
And the second one was making it ineligible for Utah residents who use SNAP benefits to purchase soda.
Yeah.
Because they argue there's no nutritional value. These are two pieces of legislation that RFK has also said they want to essentially put on a national scale and encourage other states to do so. And I will say the federal government doesn't necessarily have like a ton of power on these things. A lot of it is local control. But again, I think it amplifies or shows that Utah is saying, well, you haven't recommended this 100% yet, but we're taking the initiative before you release a statement. We're being the first person. We're being a leader. We are championing the MAHA movement. And that is something that RFK even said while he was visiting here, that Utah is a leader in the Make America Healthy Again initiative.
Well, it's something that you mentioned to us that you think that part of what this is all about is the local Republican Party sort of moving to fall more in line with the national Republican Party.
Yeah. And I think that's, I mean, kind of evident. Again, there wasn't any federal mandate. There was no threats to federal funding. Like, it was a talking point. It was this is something that I would like to get done if I was the health secretary of the United States. And what Utah said was, okay, I mean, you don't have to tell us. You don't have to recommend it. We're just going to do it. And there could be some like political trade-offs with that as well. Something that we heard during the visit from RFK from House Speaker Mike Schultz is that he had requested with the federal government to be a testing ground for different projects ranging from public health to transportation.
So they want to do more of this.
They want to do more of this in an era where DOGE is flexing spending cuts or research cuts. Utah's like, no, we want to be a national experience. Continue giving us federal funds so we can essentially do what you want. These are now conversations that Mike Scholl wants to have. Like, this is his quote. "We'd like to stand as a national experiment, allowing the state of Utah to keep some of its federal dollars and tax dollars. We manage more effectively, more efficiently, more affordably than the federal government, certainly."
So Speaker Scholz is saying that – it's interesting. He's saying that maybe we can escape some of these DOGE cuts related to science if we sign on to – more of these MAHA initiatives?
Or maybe just more federal initiatives in general.
Huh.
Right? And I think that Utah has other examples of where they have essentially fallen in lockstep with the conversations that were happening from the federal Republican level before they were actually enacted. An example is removing diversity, equity, and inclusion requirements or facilities in public schools and in government jobs. That happened prior to Trump signing an executive order to do so. They just did it.
Yeah.
And I think this is another example of we're not waiting to be told to do something. We are just going to do it because we know we support the president, we support the administration, and this is a way for us to show our support. And they also think it's good public policy.
Yeah. Let me ask you finally something you had mentioned to us. You said that this could raise the question of whether Utah – maybe in some ways sort of shifting away from its relationship with science. Do you want to say more about that?
I do think that this is pretty fascinating of where Utah, at least maybe a little bit from an outsider perspective too, I didn't grow up here. But moving in here and learning more about especially Mormon culture, where they really encourage their members to become doctors, to become lawyers, to get these like high level degrees that are really predicated on a lot of science, and then to, you know, go forth and prosper. And we've seen that with the University of Utah. They have a great medical program. We have a renowned medical school. We do renowned research here. And that's something that Utah has really, really championed, was following the science, innovating the science, like essentially being the science. And this idea of fluoride, which had been championed by a lot of healthcare officials in the state of Utah, they've been one of the most vocal supporters of it. Even though Utah was like a little like hesitant to fluoridate the water to begin with.
Yeah.
But they've, you know, we've always kind of followed the science. They've always advanced the science. And it seems to some folks that I've spoken to and like heard speak during public comments and whatnot, that this seems like a regression from that stance and from those reputations that Utah has built in the science world.
Sage Miller, thank you.
Thank you.
Sage Miller, she's a politics reporter for KUER. She co-hosts the podcast State Street. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about Utah's ban on fluoride in public water, the first in the country. When he signed the bill, Governor Spencer Cox said he didn't really care all that much about it. He said Utah had run what he called a natural experiment on fluoride because about half the state has it in their water, half doesn't. So he said you'd think we would have seen these drastically different outcomes, only we haven't, he said. So he signed it. The thing is, Utah's ban doesn't actually say anything about the safety of fluoride. It's not that it didn't matter to lawmakers or the governor. They did hear testimony about its dangers and its benefits, but the law itself says nothing about that. So just how safe is fluoride or how dangerous? To help us sort that out, we turned to Merrill Horn. She's a producer for the podcast Science Versus, and their latest episode is about the science of fluoride. Merrill started working through the research, and there's a lot of it. The show has 105 citations, but also it's not as much as you'd think for reasons we'll discuss. But we started with her expectations before she dug in.
I remember when I first heard about the idea that fluoride might be bad for us was when I was in San Francisco, and I remember seeing like posters up on telephone poles. It was like warning people, like, don't drink the water. And I just associated it with kind of like a fringe far left movement that's against vaccines. And I kind of, in my head, if I had a bias going into this, was that like, fluoride is probably fine. And I had known just the general consensus from dentistry is that it's fine. It's good. It's good in the toothpaste. It's good in the water. So that was my bias going into it.
On the show, on the podcast, you talk about the sort of the beginnings of all of this, which you describe as kind of a detective story. Do you mind sort of taking us through that, how fluoride gets discovered?
Yeah. So there's this dentist, Frederick McKay, who is the first person to have noticed that. I mean, the first thing that he saw was that when he moved to Colorado Springs, so this was like 1901, he moves to this new place to open up his dental practice and starts seeing a bunch of patients with really dark brown staining on their teeth. And at first, they had no idea what was causing this, but it starts him on this quest to like determine what is making people's teeth turn brown that it took him 3 decades to actually get to the root cause of. There is this breakthrough that happened when he was visiting another place in Arkansas that also had the staining. And they, you know, noticed that, oh, actually only started happening after a particular date when they switched the water supply. And so they looked at like, well, what's in this new water supply that they started using? And it was the fluoride.
So McKay figures out fluoride is causing the staining. So that's one part of the mystery works out. But the other part, of course, the sort of critical part is that it also happens to protect teeth from decay. That was the other revelation about this stuff.
Yeah, exactly. That whole time, they had also sort of just noticed like, these teeth also don't really have any tooth decay. And then we started looking more into that. And it eventually led to this kind of trial run of water fluoridation in 1945.
Grand Rapids, Michigan, the first city that does it. And as you say in the podcast, it worked.
Yeah. No, those like initial studies were dramatic. They found that after Grand Rapids started fluoridating the water, the kids who had grown up there had like 70% less tooth decay. So it looked like it was working amazingly.
So the arguments out there range from the really dire and kind of scary, like it's a neurotoxin, it's in rat poison, so it makes bones brittle. But then there's the concerns that are not as explosive, like, well, you know, we don't know that much about how bad it might be necessarily, but we have better dental care now than we used to, and we probably don't. It's just, it's not going to kill you, but it's just maybe not necessary. It seems like there's a range of the ways of thinking about fluoride. Is that right?
Yeah. Well, there's the, you know, the fears about it, and those range from like, oh, it might be like still causing a little bit of that staining that we first saw, to it's a neurotoxin. And then there are questions around the benefits. This idea that like, sure, we used to see these huge dramatic benefits, but today we have fluoride in the toothpaste too. So, you know, one of the huge things that's changed since those original studies were done. And so like, if we're getting it from the toothpaste anyway, there's this question of whether or not it's really providing any benefit at all to still also have it in the water.
Right. Okay, so let's talk about the concerns first. So there's the concerns and then there's the benefits. And one of the things you sort of explore for the show was whether fluoride has an effect on the development of people's brains. Let's talk about what you find there and maybe talk about the work of this epidemiologist you found at the University of Florida, Ashley Mallon.
Yeah. So Ashley Mallon had done a study where they looked at a couple hundred pregnant people in California, in the LA area.
Right.
And they checked how much fluoride the pregnant people were getting, you know, exposed to or taking in. And so this is fluoride from not just the water, but other sources too.
Yeah.
Since apparently, I didn't know this, but there's a lot of fluoride in like black tea that's also used in pesticides. So this is like total fluoride that these pregnant people have, you know, in their bodies, roughly. And then they checked 3 years later. So this is after their kids were born, another three. And they had the mothers fill out surveys to ask for kind of whether they had a whole range of neurodevelopmental symptoms. So things like anxiety, yeah. ADHD, that kind of a thing. And when they did this, they did find that they were more likely to have symptoms related to stuff like anxiety and ADHD. So, yeah, they found something there.
The study, as you say in the show, found that the children had nearly double the odds of developing these neurobehavioral problems. That seems significant, right?
Yeah, it was higher than I was expecting. I remember when I first saw this study, it gave me pause. Like, it was the first time it really hit me that, like, fluoride might actually be doing something bad to us. And it was pretty shocking, I remember.
And we should point out, as you do on the podcast, that it wasn't just this one study. You found eight studies altogether that did a similar kind of analysis. Six of those eight had the same kinds of conclusions.
Yeah. These are all studies looking at in utero exposure to fluoride overall, and they either found problems like lowered IQ or an increase in neurodevelopmental problems, neurodevelopmental behaviors.
Meryl, what else did you find about the other concerns you hear from people like Robert F. Kennedy Jr. that, you know, it makes your bones weak, it increases the risk of thyroid disease? What did you find out about that and fluoride?
That wasn't overall as concerning to me, since there's just a lot fewer studies finding any risks there. But it was a little frustrating that there wasn't more research on it, like take the concern that it's going to give us thyroid disease. There's only a handful of papers that have really looked at whether the levels of fluoride that we're putting in the water, whether that can actually give us something like hypothyroidism. And they're kind of mixed.
Yeah,
like
yeah.
One found there was an increase in hypothyroidism in people who had fluoridated water with more fluoride in it. Another study didn't find anything. And so it just left me kind of like, well, there's nothing that alarming about this literature, but it made me wish that we had better research showing for sure that it's safe.
Which is weird. And it is one of the questions you take up in the show. I mean, you ask, why don't we have a more definitive consensus about this? And as you ask, I think, Ashley Mallon, the researcher, is it a failure of science, kind of a failure of science? What was the answer?
Yeah, she thinks that it has to do with the fact that there's sort of a taboo in science around studying water fluoridation or fluoride in general. She said that up until 10 years ago, you'd be considered a tinfoil hat wearing conspiracy theorist to even ask the question of whether this could be doing some bad. And that's something I heard from a few scientists who did feel like the consensus is so in favor of fluoride is safe, you know, there's nothing wrong with water fluoridation, that they felt like their research was a little harder to get published because of that kind of bias against asking these questions. So I think that that might have something to do with it. And one big question still is whether the water fluoridation specifically is doing anything like what Ashley's study found. So she was looking at total fluoride and did see this link. But the weird thing is when studies have looked at whether drinking fluoridated water will lower your IQ later in life, those studies don't find anything.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned this because there's the question of whether it's, you know, has an effect on a developing brain or a fetus. But what about the grown-ups? Like, what about the adults?
Yeah, we have these studies that look at whether kids who are drinking fluoridated water later have a lower IQ and don't find anything. It also gives me confidence in giving my own kids fluoridated water because it seems like the risks here are really mostly found in the like prenatal period.
Yeah. Okay. So to the good part, I guess, of fluoride, Let's talk about what you found there. And what you focus on in the show anyway, and I'm sure there were a lot of other stuff you focused on, but what you talk about in the show is this study that plays out in Calgary, Canada. Talk about this study.
Yeah. So this researcher, Lindsay McLaren, started this study when her city, Calgary, decided to stop fluoridating water. 10 years ago, she figured this was a good opportunity to look at whether the kids' teeth actually got more cavities after they stopped doing this.
Yeah.
And they looked all over her city for a year to measure how many cavities kids were getting. And this was 7 years after they stopped fluoridating the water. So it's really kind of enough time to get a read for like, how bad is it?
Yeah.
And then they also did this whole thing in another city that kept fluoridating their water that was nearby called Edmonton.
What'd they find?
Well, they found that in the city in Calgary, where they had stopped water fluoridation, 65% of the kids there had at least one cavity.
Right.
And that's compared to in the city that kept fluoridating their water, only 55% of those kids had any cavities.
So is 10% significant?
You know, that's not as big as the effect was back in the 1940s when we first started doing this.
Yeah.
But it's still significant. And it wasn't just cavities. Like, there's other studies around the world have found that kids who don't have as much fluoride in their water are more likely to get their teeth extracted. They're more likely to need intense dental work where they need to get put under dental general anesthesia. So it felt significant to me.
So it matters for kids and their developing teeth. What about the grown-ups?
It generally doesn't seem to matter as much for adults. By the time we're adults, our teeth are harder. They're more kind of resilient to cavities. We're better at brushing our teeth than little kids are. So it's a little hard to tell exactly how bad it is, but the best study I could find on this said that there was just 2% less tooth decay for adults who lived in places with fluoride, with more fluoride in the water.
Hmm. So there's this other part of the show that I wanted to ask you about. It's the part that interests us because in a couple of weeks, Utah is going to get rid of fluoridation in the public water supply. And there's an interesting part, at least this interested you, how the people of Calgary reacted when they saw the results, which might give us a sense of how Utahns might be thinking about this in the not too distant future. So what did you find there?
Well, so after they they stopped fluoridating their water, these studies from Lindsay McLaren started coming out showing that kids were getting more cavities. People in Calgary decided to add fluoride to their water again. 62% of the people voted yes when they put this to the vote. So they decided to kind of reverse course.
Meryl, what have you noticed about the way this story is playing out now? Because it's not just about whether the science says fluoride is safe or not safe. It's taking place in this, you know, kind of political environment. And I wondered, I guess finally, what effect do you think the culture part, you know, the political part plays in trying to work out if the science is right or the way people react to the science or whether, in fact, scientists even dare raise these questions?
Yeah, I think I do tend to see a little bit of a bias still in like, you know, news articles coming from more left-leaning outlets not really mentioning the risks. So I know to look for it. I'm like, oh, are they going to mention the fact that we do have all these studies saying that being exposed to fluoride overall prenatally has been associated with these brain risks? And a lot of places still aren't talking about it. So I think that's too bad. I think that ideally we would have more data and also just like conversations that can hold these two things at once because it is so complicated. Like, yes, it's good for the teeth. Yes, we need to study it more. And there might be some risks to the brain in pregnancy. And so it makes me like sad that we can't all like talk about this together in a kind of more open way.
Meryl Horn, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Meryl Horn, She's a producer for the podcast Science Versus. We'll put a link to that episode on our website, radiowest.org. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. We're on YouTube at KUER90.1. We're on Instagram at Radio West, or you can email us at radiowest@kuer.org. Our intern is Katrina Cano, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Carrie Watson is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.